The views and opinions of shows on KCNR are those of the hosts, guests, and callers only, and do not necessarily reflect those of the staff, management, or advertisers of KCNR Radio.
Hello! Oops. Nope. I'm not in there. No one's on.
Nobody's on.
It's just the music. Oh, wait, now we're on.
There we
I was
go.
Like, hey, nobody's on.
Hate to disappoint you. You were on the whole time.
Oh, man.
Testing 1, 2.
That's what I get for getting here early. We were here at 12:03 in our chairs with our computers on.
Yeah,
just
2 minutes is considered early.
Just for the record.
Yeah.
Just, well, there you are. Now
there
you're
I
on.
Am. Yeah, there you are. Yeah, okay, now I'm not in the can anymore.
Yeah, you were in a land far, far away. Okay, so...
Hi, everyone.
Although
I'm really here now.
Although we'd like to goof off more, we're not going to because this is an amazing topic.
I have to goof off.
What?
You told me I could goof off if I came on a radio with
you. I lied. I lied. That's all over now.
I'm sad.
All right. So, you're listening to We the People Radio. For those of you who didn't already know that, please follow us online, wethepeopleradio.us. The information about our guest today, the book. You're going to need the book. It's awesome.
It's frightening.
Yeah, but it's awesome before it's frightening. Because, see, nobody's going to order if it's frightening. I got to say, it's awesome. And then it's frightening.
It's awesomely frightening.
It's called Technocracy Rising, the Trojan Horse of Global Transformation. And we have the author here, Patrick M. Wood. I don't know what the M stands for. It must be for Mary Scary, huh? Because this is a very scary book. And it's stuff we already know. This will make sense for people, actually. All the stuff you can't figure out. Why does the judicial system seem to be upside down? Why are all our laws about land use totally crazy? Why do they hate Christianity? And why does there seem to be such a bias there? What's up with the smart meters and the smart grid and all this other nuttiness? This pulls all that stuff. And for those of you who are interested in one world government... actually, you're probably interested in not having one world government. We got that, too. Today is the entire grab bag all in one place. So, I'm Aaron. Got Bill.
Bill,
commonly known as Willis.
Just Bill.
and we've got Bob.
Just Bob.
And we've...
Howdy.
We got Bob up to the task of finding us some good music to bring some levity to this topic. So... That's it, huh? Phone number? I'll give that out, since I always forget. 530-605-4567. Actually, if you go to the webpage, you can join us on the chat room, too. A lot of people don't want to call with a question, but you might want to write one in. So go to the site, wethepeopleradio.us. Click on the brown tab that says something about click here, and you can be on the chat room. I forget what it says. Click and listen and join the chat every Sunday noon to 2. If you click on that, you'll be there.
You know, getting back to the book, Technocracy Rising, some really good history in that. I really enjoyed some of the stuff that from the 20s and 30s that talked about in that book. That's where it really was kind of scary, because it's all coming back around now with a vengeance, even though it was kind of enforced then, but it was put down. But now it's back, and it's stronger than ever.
They've got the framework in place.
Oh, everything's in place. So now they're going to make a run at it.
And for those of you who live in California, or who like to make fun of California, or who think California is wholly nutty, wait till you hear what they were doing in the 30s, up through the mid-60s. I won't spoil the surprise. Duh, evil surprise. So, Mr. Wood.
I'm here.
Are you hiding in there? We can hear you scurrying about in there.
I'm lurking in the background.
Yeah, we can hear funny noises.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Pens, papers.
Not trying to make funny noises.
Clickening, clickening, clickening.
Yeah, kind of like a weird.
A very clear line this time. What are we on, Skype?
Yeah.
No.
Kind of love Skype.
Yeah, great.
So, Bill has your bio over there. He's hogging it because he forgot paper today. Hold on, let me get it from him so I can properly. You have quite a rich and varied history. Let's see. Here's his short bio. It says short bio, so I'm just going to read it as it is. It says Patrick Wood is an author. bingo, and a lecturer who's studied elite globalization policies since the late 1970s when he partnered with the late Anthony C. Sutton to co-author Trilaterals Over Washington, Volumes 1 and 2. I think we are all going to need that when we get done. He remains a leading expert on the elitist Trilateral Commission, their policies and achievements in creating their self-proclaimed new international economic order. Gee, doesn't that sound tidy?
Sounds familiar.
An economist by education, a financial analyst and a writer by profession, and an American constitutionalist by choice, Wood maintains a biblical worldview and has deep historical insights into the modern attacks on sovereignty, property rights, and personal freedom. Such attacks are epitomized by the implementation of UN policies such as Agenda 21, sustainable development, smart growth, and in education, the widespread adoption of Common Core. Wood is a frequent speaker. We've seen him live, and a guest on radio shows here and around the nation. He currently, his current research builds on Trilateral Commission hegemony, focusing on transhumanism. That was a thing I was not super familiar with. I think you guys will be interested in that. Technocracy and scientism, and how these are co-opting economics, politics, and religion around the world. And seriously, this is going to make sense of a lot of stuff for people. So, that being said, Take it away, Mr. Wood. Where would you like to go?
Oh, boy. Well, I'm really glad you actually got through the book. The purpose of my writing the book was to connect the dots that had not yet been connected. And I think you've already hit on that, and you brought that out without me prompting you. Nobody has really done this yet, Aaron, as you know.
No, they haven't.
And, I would not have been in a position to do this had I not run across historic technocracy from the 1930s. I had never heard of it before a few years ago. And when I stumbled across it and started studying it, I immediately just saw that there was a huge story here. And that the word new that the Trilateral Commission originally used for new international economic order, it really meant new. It wasn't just a rehash of capitalism. But it was maybe something absolutely new that had never been tried before in the history of the world. And that fits the model of the original historic technocracy movement to a T.
So it's not really new then, is it?
No, it's not. It's a reincarnation in a sense, I suppose,
right.
Because it was dead for and out of public view for many years during the most of the 40s when it was kind of dying down, all of the 50s, all of the 60s, there was no obvious, you know, movement forward. And it was interesting that back in the 1930s, the prominent engineers and scientists who were crafting technocracy were not funded by the Rockefeller types. You know, they weren't getting huge grants or anything like that to do what they did. They simply did it. They did have some backing from Columbia University, but that was significant, but it wasn't like, you know, train loads of money that you see being passed around today by the giant trust organizations and stuff like the Rockefeller Brothers Fund. But technocracy was not brought back to the limelight again until Zbigniew Brzezinski started writing about his so-called technotronic era in 1970, and he wrote a book called Between Two Ages, America's Role in the Technotronic Era. And I'm sure some of your listeners have heard of it, have not read it along the way. It raised a lot of concern, a lot of alarm for a lot of people back then and even now. And when I started looking at technocracy, I found out pretty quickly that what he was floating in his book, Between Two Ages, was very much the same plan that was being floated back in the 1930s. And then, of course, when Brzezinski teamed up with Rockefeller, the trainloads full of money entered in. And lo and behold, we have all of a sudden over the last 40 years, we have all these different programs popping up based on the environment, on the ecology, on energy, global warming.
Education.
I mean, all these initiatives are not just happenstance things that happen because of bad luck. They have been orchestrated by this group very specifically and very precisely to bring about the state of affairs that we have in the world today. And the reason that we have so much angst in the world economically especially, but politically, you know, the economic side of things often drives politics in weird ways. But the reason we have economic angst in the world today is that there are literally two competing economic systems right now duking it out in the international market to see which one is going to win. Capitalism on one hand and technocracy on the other hand. They're diametrically opposed, diametrically opposite each other. They have nothing in common with each other whatsoever. But that's one of the reasons we see the world economically is upside down right now. There's not one country in the world you can look at and say, well, that country's got it together. Everybody's struggling with what's going on right now. And this whole climate change thing is turning economies upside down. The reason it is they want to implement this system of technocracy, and it was a replacement economic system that was developed in the 1930s. That's the key here. It's not a political coup. It's an economic coup. They want to replace capitalism with technocracy, which was originally defined and modeled as a replacement economic system to replace capitalism. That's it in a nutshell.
Well, I like this, was it page 5? I should have done what often happens. I should have highlighted the things that I didn't want to highlight and left the rest.
so much.
My highlighter was sucking wind by about page 100. In this little part here says, in order for technocracy to succeed, it's necessary to have in place a comprehensive system for the orderly management of all humans and all facets of societal operation. This includes economic, political, social, and religious. And you went on to say, furthermore, these areas must not merely be compatible, they must be so thoroughly entangled that with each other that the distinctions among them will not be obvious to their subjects. Indeed, this is the holistic approach to global governance. And that's what we're looking at. We're looking at why this big push on anti-religion, why getting it out of schools, why bringing in Common Core, why all the data mining. I mean, this isn't just about machines, technology, machines.
No, it's not an accident either. It's not just a coincidence.
This is really, really super well
in together.
Organized. We've got to take a really quick break on that note. But so for the people who have tuned in the first part, good for you. You're well on the way. We're going to go from there. And I think you'll enjoy the next couple hours with Patrick Wood. We're talking about technocracy rising here at KCNR, 1460 AM. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. Sound familiar? So, speaking with Patrick Wood, the author of Technocracy Rising, I had to catch myself there. We were talking about the chickification all the series is on television. That was their new word we learned during the break. You never know what's going on in here. So you're listening to We the People Radio. We're going to be talking about scary stuff for the next hour and a half. Mr. Wood, tell us about the Trilateral Commission. Because I don't think most people know about it, really.
Or understand what it is.
I know. I've been talking about and writing about the Trilateral Commission since the late 1980s, and the world still does not know. And it's been suppressed over the years, for sure, in the media, because mainline media just refuses to talk about these people at all. But they deserve to be talked about back then. They deserve to be talked about today. Even more so today, because now we're 40 years down the road, and we see what they've done. And so it's even more important to have a discussion today. This group, the Trilateral Commission, was started in 1973 by David Rockefeller and Zbigniew Brzezinski. And Brzezinski, we already covered a little bit. He was a professor at a Columbia University. He had written a book called Between Two Ages, America's Role in the Technotronic Era. David Rockefeller, of course, was the giant financier, industrialist, rich daddy Warbucks, whatever. He had a bunch of money. The Rockefeller family, of course, had been very active in the 1900s to bring about a system of global governance in various plans. They were instrumental in creating the United Nations and the League of Nations, and they've been involved monetarily in all kinds of crazy things over the years. But 1973 was when they got traction, when they started this Trilateral Commission. The word trilateral came from the three geographic regions from which they pulled members. It was North America, Japan, and Europe. And they had roughly one-third from each region. From North America, there was about 100, and about 86 of those were from the United States. And the membership has stayed around 300 to 350 ever since. It's not a large group. It's very selective. They have an executive committee that searches out people that they want to invite in. You can't submit your application to join. There's no fee or anything like that. Sorry, Aaron, you're out. but if they come to you and say, we want to talk to you, it's just, you have a decision to make. You can either say yes or no. But that's the way it's been over all these years. And they've grabbed people from these various societies, from the press, from legal organizations, law firms, from academia, from the corporate world, from the banking world, basically really the movers and shakers in all those different areas. And they started out, even back then, they met annually in a general plenary session, and then they also met regionally as well several times during the year to discuss regional issues. And our big concern, myself and Sutton, that is, back in 1978, this was 2 years after Jimmy Carter had been in office, and we saw Jimmy Carter, who was a member of the commission, by the way, so was Walter Mondale. This is the peanut farmer who was not connected to Washington, he said. And he also said he'd never lie to us. That was comforting. And he immediately appointed no less than a third of the U.S. membership of the Trilateral Commission to top cabinet posts. It was incredible. And it alarmed us. And you think about it for me. So, well, why would that alarm you? Well, here's the deal. These people met corporately, Japanese and European and American. They met together and discussed and hammered out issues on a global basis. They voted on stuff, and then they came back to their respective countries to implement those policies into those countries. This is not the American way. I'm sorry. It's not.
Mm-mm.
We were very concerned. Well, who's approving these policies? Who's overseeing these policies? Is Congress involved to any extent? Of course, no, they weren't. This was a complete takeover, a hijacking, if you will, of the executive branch of the U.S. government. And they did the same thing in the other nations as well, just like here. But I will stress right now, I know now, they were not after political power for the sake of political power. They were after the machinery of these various governments to craft their so-called new international economic order. They couldn't have done it without using the mechanism of government to do it. So the government takeover, if you will, was only a means to an end. It was not the end in itself. And this is one major point that we really need to get a hold of. It's not about political control. It's about economic control. And then you could say at the end of that as a tagline, and oh, by the way, obviously it's going to affect the way that you live and the way that they tell you what you can and can't do. But that's an almost an afterthought in a sense. They're after economic control, and they've just about got it now.
They really do. And, the other thing in the book that I thought was really nice, just by way of feedback that way, is all the trilateral, all the members of the Trilateral Commission, whenever you refer to one of them, they're in bold print. So you didn't have to look back at some stupid list and try to remember who was who at the zoo, Because a lot of these names are familiar, as you flip through, you're like, oh, yeah, I remember that guy. Now, who was Warren Christopher again? Oh, yeah, that's right. And you did a really good job of laying out who all those folks were. Tell me about Bill and Melinda Gates, though. I just looked it up on page 92. You refer to them. It doesn't show they're part of it. But where do they plug in? I had somebody in the chat room asking about that.
Well, they are not members themselves of the Trilateral Commission, but they are the outcome of the United Nations recommendation to use NGOs to create an education system for sustainable development. And the United Nations, as I detail in my book, is the contagion that was used to spread this stuff all over the world. It may have started out in some boardroom or something, or some university boardroom in, I don't know, New York or wherever. But they had to have a contagion to spread it around the world, and the United Nations was a willing and able agent to do that. So we see the United Nations supporting these programs and suggesting these programs and stuff. And so everywhere that we, you know, like we trace back to Agenda 21, for instance, the Common Core education standards is just right. A byproduct, an outcome, if you will, of the Agenda 21 document, which also was sponsored by the United Nations. So the original, the early technocrats specified an educational system, and they basically just came right out and said it needs to be a system of total conditioning of the youth, not education as much as training. And that's, of course, what we see with Common Core. It's, they're training people to do a job, kind of like you would train, you know, like you would train a dog to fetch a bird or something in the field. They're being trained to respond to a stimulus rather than to be educated so that they can think critically about, you know, the world and about issues and problems and stuff like that. And part of the reason, just to kind of close the loop on that, part of the reason that they want to do this is that they must have people that are willing to succumb to sustainable development. In other words, you play according to the group needs, not yours. It's all about the group. It's all about the larger public good, or it's all about your community, your town, your state, your country, or whatever, your world. And you personally are selfish if you think you have any personal rights in this. So you're encouraged in Common Core and No Child Left Behind, back under George Bush, by the way, which is just, you know, part A of this.
You mean Race to the Bottom?
You know, same thing. As this is just on steroids. The whole deal is to condition these poor little minds to just succumb to the greater good. And everything they do now is going to be a stimulus to support all the things we're going to be talking about here, whether it be global warming, whether it be the green economy, whether it be smart grid, whether it be, I don't know, you know, on down the line.
All the sustainable development and all that
all
stuff.
All the sustainable development stuff.
Sure.
Well, yeah, I'm curious to hear what you have to say about the green economy, because we do a lot of not a lot, but a fair amount of
we bash it as much as we can. Environmentalism, that's what Bill's trying to say.
Yeah, I mean, this whole environmental movement in this country has gone so overboard. I'm curious to hear what you have to say about how that ties in with the whole green economy portion of this same program.
Well, you know, you have to go back. You can't understand it just looking at the modern iteration. You really have to understand historic technocracy to get it. Mm-hmm. Because they were the intellectual architects of this. And you have to hand it to engineers on this one thing. They do know how to document stuff. You know, they're very good at that. If you give an engineer a project, the first thing he's going to do is pull out his pencil and his quad paper, and he's going to start documenting it from the get-go.
Right.
And writing down, what do I need to get it done, and what are the calculations, and you know, what are the outcomes we expect, how are we going to monitor it, et cetera. So the engineers back then just did a great job of doing this. And by the way, let's say up front, I am not anti-engineer, I'm not anti-scientist any way, shape, or form. I'm not anti-technology either. In fact, I love technology. As we're going to discuss as we go through this, the big question is, will technology serve me?
Yeah.
Or will I have to serve technology? There's a big difference here. Same technology, you see, but the question is, who's going to serve who? I'm okay if technology serving me, I have no problem. But if technology puts a bite on me and says, you're going to do what I tell you to do, like in the case of global warming, for instance, you know, if it says, well, you have to reduce your carbon footprint. Well, okay, technology's coming after me now. I don't like that. And that's kind of the whole issue here.
Right. Well, in keeping with the whole philosophy of technocracy, they're using fake science, and it's all about a belief system, and
don't
you believe in global warming? It's like, hey, you know what? If it's scientific, I shouldn't have to believe in it, you knucklehead. But then once I understood that you have to get rid of, like, a Bible-based worldview and replace science with
Replace religion with science.
Religion with science, then... Yeah, I get it. That's why I have to believe in it, because I've got to replace belief in a creator, because obviously he's outmoded, outdated.
Well, that's exactly right.
So it's take a quick break and thank our advertisers, because they're not outdated and outmoded. We like them,
right?
Unless they're bad, in which case we'll tell you.
Right. So for those engineers and scientists that might be listening today, we're not bashing you. We're not bashing people that are given to good science and good engineering practices.
No, we need them. Yeah.
But on the other hand, if your goal is to create a system of global governance and a system, an economic system that is intended to control man and mankind, we'll fight you to the death. That's just that simple.
Yeah, we
either give up your beliefs, give up your religious beliefs and science, and just go back to practicing good science and good engineering, or we're going to have conflict. That's all I can say.
Yeah, we want to keep our flaws. We like them just the way they are. All right, we'll be back with you in 2 minutes. Our guest is Patrick Wood. We're talking about Technocracy Rising, the book. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us, here at KCNR, 1460 AM.
Smiling faces sometimes pretend to be your friend. Smiling faces show no traces of the evil that lurks within. Smiling faces, smiling faces, sometimes they don't tell the truth. Smiling faces, smiling faces, tell lies, and I got you.
It's all good until the Save Me San Francisco part. But hey, perfect segue to our guest on the phone, our caller on the phone, Paul. Paul's got a question, a comment.
Paul, you in
Paul's
there?
Paul's gone.
Yeah, hang on.
Whoa. Paul might be in there.
Oh, hold on.
We're working on it.
All right, try it now.
Paul?
Hello.
Hey.
I hear you.
Fire away.
Is this Aaron?
It is.
Oh, hi, Aaron.
Hey, how's it going?
Paul.
People.
I have an idea how we could improve the economy and create 100,000 jobs. It would be basically to build 100,000 solar-powered houses, where each house has 100 solar panels on the roof up there in the state of Jefferson, and each house would generate twice as much energy as it needs, so it could sell the energy to the neighbors, and if you charge like 49 cents a kilowatt-hour, either selling it to PG&E or anybody wants to buy it, you could create a lot of jobs. It would create a solar economy. It would stop the climate emergency, and it would make the state of Jefferson economically independent from the state of California. If you built enough of these solar-powered houses, it would shift the whole economy. You know, homeowners could pay their mortgage from solar energy. I was over in Germany last summer, and I met homeowners who were paying the whole mortgage from the 100 solar panels they had on the roof of a fourplex, and they had tenants in there. And so the energy
figure.
I
said, well, go figure. I guess as long as we, if we weren't subsidizing solar so much, that's always the part that kills us, is we're paying so much for it on the other end.
There's no subsidy for solar. What it is a market mechanism where it's sort of like crowd funding, where in Germany, everybody pays a small amount. The smelting companies pay maybe $1,000 a month extra. The tenants pay $2 a month extra, and they some Berlin TV station interviewed one tenant one day, and it was so funny, it went viral. The reporter asked the tenant, "Do you mind paying $2 a month extra for solar energy?" And the tenant said, "Well, I pay $20 a month for beer, so why would I mind paying $20 a year for solar if we can shut down all the nukes and ban fracking?" And that little short segment just went viral all over Germany.
Huh. Well, thanks, Paul. We'll get input from Patrick point? Here. I did.
What's Patrick's response to the idea of solar?
I don't know, but let's find out.
Well, okay. Yes.
So many thoughts, so little time.
Yeah, I know. It's as an economic issue, the free market works. I'll just leave it at that. Free market principles have worked for thousands of years. They work very well. There's nothing wrong with them. And within the bounds of free enterprise, where people can enter into agreements freely with each other without government intervention, I think that's wonderful. And there's a jillion and one schemes that will work to build an economic system. But what one needs to understand here is that the capitalist system that we enjoy today is going to be completely destroyed and replaced by the system of technocracy. So all of the free enterprise principles that we understand and enjoy today, they're going to be gone. You can't think of the world in terms of free enterprise anymore. These people are taking this away from us. They're taking the freedom of choice away. They're taking capitalism away. They're taking price-based economics away. If you think in terms of currency, you're thinking wrong. They're thinking in terms of energy currency, not green dollar bills like you and I spend. They're not talking about supply and demand where prices are based on, you know, like greater supply than demand and so on, where price finds equilibrium. They're talking about basing everything on energy credits, an energy currency that has absolutely nothing to do with the concepts of modern currency that we have right now in our head.
So and, Al Gore didn't invent carbon credits?
No, he didn't. It was actually the whole thing was scripted back in the 1930s. I found pictures of actual energy credit cards that they were intending to use. And I will say that they didn't have the technology back in those days to really implement it on a societal basis. But they do today. They do now.
I'm not sure we have the technology today to put 100 solar panels on somebody's roof and generate income. I mean, just the cost alone of that, if you're not going to get somebody to pay for it, you're going to be years down the road before that ever pays for itself. So I'm not totally sold on that particular technology right now. Maybe, you know, in the future it might work. But my understanding is with solar, if you don't get a subsidy to install that, which
yeah,
is basically
a tax break,
which is you know, basically
a subsidy.
Taxpayers are kicking in to help pay for.
And remember, who brought us the whole solar idea and alternative ideas in the first place? Who brought all those things to the table? It was not industry. People did not bring this to the table. All of this stuff was brought to us because those who were pushing technocracy wanted to have this alternative energy system in to get rid of oil, to get, you know, oil and coal, right, and all those things. That's what God gave this planet to fuel itself. But that's neither here nor there. That it is, you know, that's the fuel
like
that we
it.
Have. We have it in abundance. All of the alternative energy right now would not even be in play at all had there not been government subsidies by these very same technocrats to try and make it economically viable. And it still is not economically viable. You can talk about wind farms. You can talk about solar panels. You can talk about generating energy with waves in the ocean.
Oh, we can put some mirrors up to reflect the heat.
Oh, wait.
That's
and
right.
Then the birds will think they're water.
You end up killing birds. And
yeah. I mean,
you know, the windmill generators, you go look along the ground and you see birds all over the place. It's like.
Yeah, and the technology works. I mean, but it's not feasible. And you're not going to be able to replace what we have in fossil fuel energy with this type of a program.
Yes. And I would say beware of anything that a technocrat hands you and says this is good for you.
It'll save you money. We look at like the smart meters. I mean, if you want to use Germany as an example, you know, the smart meters in Germany, they don't have any in the places where those are fully functional. They don't have any thermostats. The central planning decides how warm and how cold your house will be. How great is that? They decide when your appliances will work, when you're allowed to wash your clothes, use a dishwasher if you've got one.
Well, you're not smart enough to know when to turn your own thermostat down.
Exactly. I mean, you're literally like a hamster in a cage.
Yeah.
You know, they might turn the light on for you sometimes, but maybe not.
Hey, you are. I had a friend that moved from Germany to Switzerland, and she was the wife was washing her clothes one day, and the washing machine stopped.
Get out.
While the thing was full of water. And she goes, oh, no, what am I going to do? So she calls a plumber. Finally, she gets somebody to come and look at it. And they laugh when they come in and say, oh, lady, they shut it off. And she says, what? She said, yeah, they shut it off. Come back midnight or something. You turn it on and you can finish your load. And so it had to sit the rest of the day in the water, the dirty water, getting cold.
Lovely.
And she freaked out. It was very disturbing to find this out for the first time. But this is happening all over the world.
Well, and the technocrats and the bureaucrats and the crats just don't, they're not paid to care. Which is what people are seeing this now. They go to Social Security is a huge offender. People go to the Social Security Administration and they get treated like cattle. And they're like, yeah, but you did this to me, you did that to me, it's affecting me. Well, we'll get back to you in 6 months or a year. IRS is in the process of telling everybody they don't care. And cutting their budget doesn't make them more efficient, it just makes them work slower. It's amazing. We're seeing this everywhere. So if people think that being managed by these folks is going to be better, oh my gosh!
And it all ties right back into what you were talking about on the whole green economy. They don't want us to use our natural resources.
No, we're sitting right in the middle of them. That's really where our wealth is. I would say that to Paul. Actually, if we want this area in Northern California to be productive and self-sustaining again, we utilize our resources. Trees grow back. It's an amazing thing. And if we cut some of them, we'd probably have more water. We need to take a quick break on that happy note. Bob. Oh, look at him go. We'll be right back with you in 2 minutes. We're here at KCNR 1460 AM with Patrick Wood, the author of Technocracy Rising.
When I was young, it seemed that life was so wonderful. A miracle. Oh, it was beautiful, magical. And all the birds in the trees, they be singing so happily, oh joyfully, oh playfully, watching me. But then they sent me away, teach me how to be sensible, logical, oh responsible, practical. And then they showed me a world where I could be so dependable.
And I like his, creepy voice. Who was that? Or who is that?
That's Morrissey.
Oh, man. You've got the stalker voice going. All right. So we have David in San Francisco has a question for Mr. Wood. Fire away, David.
Hey, greetings. I'm pretty knowledgeable about the cross-section of different technocrats. It does go back into the 1800s when science was kind of freeing the poor schmuck who was stuck in a dead-end job, you know, stuck in the woods, stuck in the, you know, in a kind of a useless life that they had to pay endless money to the, you know, to the bankers and whatnot. And so technocracy started as a kind of an optimistic movement, but it ended up really ruining its reputation when the Nazis, you know, these kind of bureaucratic, pure science types that started, you know, studying people in the, you know, in the concentration camps to death. And all of those research projects those old Nazi doctors were doing, you could call them technocrats. But I take offense at the idea that the small solar producer, for example, about the last caller, people who want to just go back to a simpler way of living and use technology in a local way, those are not technocrats. And,
I don't think he's saying that. Patrick, are you saying, you're not saying that, are you?
Not at all.
No, I didn't get that impression.
We specifically said that if technology serves me, fine. It's when I have to serve technology that there's a problem. I'm very clear about that. I'm not anti-technology in any way, shape, or form. If you got the money and you want to do something, go do it. Be my guest.
Well, that's fine. I'm both an economist as well as somebody who's studied economics in the last 20 years. You got to realize that organized crime dominates it. These bank, you know, shell games that they've been playing, the way that the ratings agencies and the power companies and the stadiums and all of the big institutions are always doing the wrong thing, it's very much dominated by organized crime. So when you start looking at the power companies, look at the nuclear incident in Japan, TEPCO, Tokyo Electric Power, they still have control of their operation when they've been obviously frauding, lying, mismanaging that project from the beginning. They actually were using organized crime to round up poor schmucks to work in the cleanup of it, not giving them radiation tags and letting them get dosed to death.
Hey, David,
technocrats.
I don't think we're arguing that point, but I guess what I'm getting at is, if you want to put solar panels on your roof, more power to you. I think that's fantastic. But why should I have to kick in so you can do that when I have no interest in putting solar panels on my roof?
Well, first of all, the big power companies, you're already paying them. If they have a nuclear plant, you're paying them so much down the road, and they're not even safe, doing a safe job. The coal companies, they're already, you're paying them to haul it by train and barge, and the black lung is already coming out of your April 15th taxes. Solar, on the other hand, the big neocon scream fest is always about, what was that company? But that was actually an investment.
Solyndra.
Yeah, that was actually, the U.S. government invested in it. It was not a subsidy by any terms. It was an investment,
okay,
and that investment broke only because somebody tried to corner the market on the raw materials, and they bottomed out the prices at the wrong time.
Okay, we've got literally 45 seconds till the computer cuts us off here at the top of the hour. Mr. Wood, you want to begin the response, and then we'll carry it over into the next.
I will just give a response here to you, Dave. This is a kind of a diversionary phone call, as far as I'm concerned. It's interesting, but diversionary. And if you are an economist, I would challenge you to go study the economic system of technocracy as it was originally designed and as it's being implemented today by the United Nations and others, and try and apply your economic principles to technocracy. There are no economists in the country, in the world, as far as I know, that are studying it from this perspective today. If you really want to get a handle on it, do that, because all the rest of the stuff you're talking about is going to be swept away if technocracy really does get implemented around the world. All these discussions will be moot.
Right on. Okay, we're going to come back for another full hour here. You're listening to We the People Radio. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. You're listening to KCNR 1460 AM, Shasta Redding. All righty there. We're back. You are listening to We the People Radio. Join us online. What do you have that smirk on your face?
Hello, Mr. Obvious. I want to put solar panels on my roof, and before I do, I wonder how much free government money I can get before, because I really don't have any money, but I want to put them on there, and then I can sell the power. But somebody has to pay for it first.
Yeah, we were late coming back from our break because Bill was in a rage, and I broke some much needed plumbing here.
Yeah, we need to get our plumbing
studio
subsidized.
Yeah, there are a lot of things going on here.
My plumbing's getting clogged up.
Solar panels couldn't help me on that one. Hey, Mr. Wood, we want to make sure. Well, we tried to snark around with you during the break, but you were gone. We had some free snark. We had some free snarking time, so we were going to hang
out.
First
time caller, long time listener.
Exactly. Oh my gosh. Okay, so at the risk of creating chaos, the phone number here is 530-605-4567. And if you call in the last 2 minutes, we're not taking your call. Just want to let you know. And I guarantee you someone will call in the last 2 minutes because they always do. Oh, funny. If you have questions you want to write to us, why don't you pop in online, wethepeopleradio.us, where you will find all the information about this book that you must have. It is called Technocracy Rising, and seriously, you need it, because it really is a great roadmap of all sorts of things that you might know some of them. You might actually know about all these different pieces, but when you see them all put together in the puzzle correctly, I think it's going to make a lot of sense for you.
You know, one thing I would like to mention is
are you going to be Mr. Obvious, or are you going to be Bill?
No, I'm okay now. My blood pressure's back down. But you know, the last caller mentioned the Nazis, and you know, he was closer on target than you might think, because there is a correlation between the Nazis and some early California history.
Yeah,
I was
come
reading
on,
in
do
your
that
book.
Part.
Let's talk about that. I mean, I found that very fascinating.
Well, yeah, we had the whole area of eugenics was big in California for years in the early 1900s, and Nazi Germany, historians have now documented, Nazi Germany got most of their eugenics model from the California model.
Amazing.
Kind of frightening.
Yes.
It really is. But there were so many screwy ideas going around back in those early days in the early 1900s. It's no surprise that something like that happened.
Well, it's no surprise something like that could have started in California either.
Well, I know. That's not surprising either. What is surprising is how long it persisted until people finally said, hey, we're getting rid of this stuff.
What the heck? Because here, let's see, page 101. Let's see, it's all highlighted. It has a wow, some asterisks, and at the bottom it says, ah! I've made my own notes. Technocracy, Inc. found its largest support in California. Eugenics was in its heyday during the 1930s, where over 20,000, I couldn't believe the numbers, 20,000 men, women, and children were deemed defective and were subsequently sterilized by force.
Yes. That's really sad, isn't it?
I would bet you no one would believe that happened in the United States ever. And that went on until what, 1960-something, or 63?
1963.
They were doing forced sterilization, and you know that because?
Because, yes, because I am, well, not a product of it, but
yeah, that's
I have a personal story. Let me put it this way, a personal testimony, if you will, because of that. But my grandmother, who was born in, when was it, like 1897 or something, I don't know, something like that. She was from Northern California. We were like, fifth generation farmers and ranchers in Northern California. And she was kind of a socialite type of a thinker, type educator type of a person back in those days. And she had a son who, as it turned out, by the time he was 5 or 6 years old, they deemed him to be mentally defective or like retarded. And because of the eugenics movement, they talked her into having her other child, happened to be my mother, sterilized so that she wouldn't have any more defective children.
Because that's what they called them, was defective.
they called them the defectives. And so my mother was forced sterilized when she was, I think, 17 or 18 years old. And she wasn't a happy camper, let me tell you, because she had all the aspirations of a young woman to have her own children. But they talked her into the idea that this is going to happen every other generation, and so you needed to get rid of the, you know, you needed to be sterilized, and they did. She, my grandmother drug her down, and they operated on her and sterilized her. So they found out several years later, about probably 20 years later, medical technology advanced and stuff, some studies were done on my uncle, and they determined he was not genetically marred at all, that he had been deprived of oxygen at birth, and that there was really nothing wrong with him physically. You know, it's just an accident that happened when he was being born, that his brain got robbed of oxygen, and it caused brain damage. But my mother was completely physically fit, if you will, genetically. And so when she found that out, she was doubly not a happy camper. It caused a rift in our family until the day she died. They both died.
Oh, my God!
Horrible rift.
Isn't that something that and again, it's happening today, that a bureaucrat can make a decision about your life, and you are forever affected by that for the rest of your life,
right,
and it can't be reversed.
That's right. And as a result of this, of course, I was adopted. That's how I came to be in the Wood family. I was adopted by my mother and father back then. And I guess you could say, in a sense, I wouldn't be here were it not for this, but that's a sick way to look at it.
That is a sick way to look at it. Well, it's interesting because you have footnoted for, you know, a lot of times people hear stuff like this and they go, oh, that's one guy, you know, who knows what his family was doing, you know. You hear all this, I can always hear the skeptics in the back of my head. But you have footnoted this. It was a 2012 article by CNN Health. And here it says, 32 states had eugenics programs, but California was in a league of its own. In California, the eugenics movement was led by figures such as David Starr Jordan, president of Stanford University, and Harry Chandler, publisher of the Los Angeles Times. California's movement was so effective that in the 1930s, members of the Nazi Party asked California eugenicists for advice on how to run their own sterilization program. Quote, Germany used California's program as its chief example that this was a working, successful policy, unquote.
Isn't that wonderful?
That's just super great.
But that's not the only connection with the Nazis that our government has had. I mean, it back then it was.
We took a bunch of the scientists too. All the, what do you call them? You know, the guys that should have gone through Nuremberg.
Yeah, the nuclear scientists that built our NASA space program came from Nazi Germany very quietly, and then later became model citizens.
Oh, yeah. You know, science is more important than actually morality, which is the whole point, right?
Yeah, they actually came back into the United States and it's under a secret operation called Operation Paperclip, which has been written about now quite extensively since everything has been declassified. But these 1,600 top scientists from Nazi Germany came back into top government labs and stuff, military labs and government positions to continue to work their scientific magic, if you will.
Yeah, it's good enough for the Nazis, it's good enough for us.
No accountability at all. Many of them got new identities altogether.
Yeah, I can't imagine why they needed that.
No kidding. I mean, some of them were really bad people.
Well, and that just kind of goes to the heart of this whole thing, that the quote-unquote science is more important than anything. More important,
that's right.
More important than our humanity, truly, and our and it's all for the brotherhood of man. I highlighted that about 80 times. So irritating. You know, it's all for the greater good. It's all for the the community. The whole is greater than the sum of its parts. That's what they're teaching with sustainable development.
That's exactly right. It would be worthwhile to, I think, just to cover a little bit some of the history of Agenda 21, because that's really where sustainable development got its kickstart, with Agenda 21. And of course, all the skeptics say, there's no such thing as Agenda 21. Well, if we had a video feed on this, I'd show you the book. I've got it right in my hands. It's a big old 350-page giant, you know, orange book and it's a very real book. And it was produced as a result of the Rio Conference in 1992, held in Rio de Janeiro, where the United Nations came together and they hammered out a policy for the world, for the future of the world, Agenda 21. And sustainable development was at the core of it. It was pure 100% unadulterated technocracy.
And we signed off on that.
But that's what it was. And where did that come from? You know, where did the whole policy of Agenda 21 come from? That's what needs to be asked. It did not just happen just because they called a convention in Rio. The backdrop to that, acknowledged now by the United Nations openly, is that the entire inspiration for the Rio Conference and Agenda 21 was the so-called Brundtland Commission that was sponsored by the United Nations a few years earlier, that was chaired by Gro Brundtland, politician from Europe, who also had a big environmental bent. And she chaired the commission, and she was the primary editor, author of the book that was produced by that called Our Common Future. That book is still in print. Go to make that the second book you get beyond Technocracy Rising, okay? You can go back. If you're going to spend more money at Amazon or whatever, go get that book too. Our Common Future, written by Gro Brundtland. This was the book that gave all of the inspiration and the intellectual material, if you will, to the Rio Conference. And the United Nations acknowledged it. Never would have happened had it not been for Gro Brundtland and Our Common Future. Gro Brundtland was a member of the Trilateral Commission. Put that in your pipe and smoke it.
Yeah, those pesky facts again.
They keep coming back. Everywhere you look, they've got their fingers in this all the way along the way. Who is the poster child for global warming?
Al the Big Idiot Gore?
Al, that's right, Al Gore. He's the first green billionaire, I think. That's what they call him. And Al Gore's a member of the Trilateral Commission, too.
And he's been pretty much, debunked straight away here in the last couple of years.
He still has carbon credits.
And
the worshippers are still out in force. Hey, we better.
It hasn't stopped him.
We've got to take a quick little break here, and we'll come right back. We got behind last time. We had all the breaks in one time. We are talking with Patrick Wood here about Technocracy Rising. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. We're here at KCNR, 1460 AM, every Sunday from noon to 2. Be right back.
Well, you filled up my head with so many lies. You twisted my heart till something snapped inside. I'd like to give it one more try, but my give a damn's busted. The problem's plain to see. Too much technology. Machines to save our lives. Machines dehumanize.
We laugh, but it's all true. The music of the 70s, they were prophets. So that could be your next book, Mr. Wood. You call it I'm Kilroy, huh?
Which book now?
Your next book. You know, it could come with a free soundtrack. We could play all the scary music about the technocrats.
Indeed. There's probably a lot of songs out there that would fit it perfectly.
Oh, my gosh. It just goes on and on and on forever. So talk about transhumanism, because that's always kind of a what? You know, it's kind of a confusing term, and it's creepy.
Well, you know, the theme in my book is transformation. I named the subtitle is called the Trojan Horse of Global Transformation, and I used that word purposely.
Mm-hmm.
to then describe all the different areas of society that are being transformed by technocracy. And so the economy is being transformed, and the governance is being transformed, energy is being transformed. You know, I brought in the idea of big data and how that's using in the transformation process, the spy systems, if you will. And the transformation process of all these different areas, including religion, are key to implementing technocracy for these people. And the one thing that you'd be tempted to leave out would be, what about the people themselves? You know, what about the individual people that will inhabit technocracy? And indeed, we find they need to be transformed as well. And that's what transhumanism is all about. It's applying technology to the human condition in order to, in one sense, to escape the laws of sin and death. They look to create a state of immortality for themselves, of omniscience for themselves, of omnipotence, where they can do anything. And they're literally trying to create, using science now, this is a movement across the world. It's not just some localized little group of people. They're trying to create humans 2.0. And they figure that humans 1.0, that's us, are inefficient, we're incapable, we tend to break things, and we get angry, and we fight each other, and we start wars, and, you know, we do all these bad things. We breed too much, for one thing. And they want to create humans in their own image that will be appropriate little citizens for the global technocracy to come. It's a pipe dream. It's a very old pipe dream, by the way. As you go back thousands of years, and you'll find attempts by man to, metaphysical attempts for the most part, to attain godhood. They all failed. They're all dead. Every one of them is dead since then. So they failed, obviously. But here we are.
Still trying to do it.
They're buying the same lie that they can do it. And so they're trying. And they're spending taxpayer money in universities all over the world to bring these scientific areas, or these areas of science, to bear on the human condition so that they can create a state of immortality and omniscience. And, you know, these are qualities that have historically been reserved for God, right? For our concept of God.
Yeah.
Well, they got bad news for them. They're gonna fail.
God's a funny man.
Well, they always have. I mean, this isn't new history. This is repeating history.
Yes, it is.
And it failed before. And I think when people really get wind of it in mass, it'll fail again. People, well, I don't think in this country will sit still for it.
Well, for all the people who think that actually that so far the things we've talked about aren't a problem for them. Because they think we can do better, and, you know, we should have solar panels on all our roofs or whatever the thing is. I shouldn't keep going back to that. But I can't help it. And so the people who think that all that kind of stuff is actually good, newsflash for you folks, this is all about data collection. And just in case you think, well, I'm not doing, in case you're one of the folks that thinks, well, I'm not doing anything bad, who cares if they spy on me or check my email or whatever, that's not it. The education system, the, I'm looking at page 113, the Affordable Care Act, in case you thought that was about health care, that's all about data collection. Same with Common Core. We talked about that last week. It's all about data collection. So once they have that in the technocracy, once they've collected all that data about you, good, bad, indifferent, and a lot of those assessments are done, you have a whole section in there about the assessments being done by unqualified people.
Exactly. Well, yeah, the collection of data is critical to the technocrat, because that's how you control the mechanism. You can't control a shop floor, for instance, a manufacturing facility, without monitoring what's going on the shop floor. You have to. And so they look at society in the same way. They say, well, we have to monitor society in order to make mid-course corrections and tell people what they need to do and get everybody to the right place just in time so they can, you know, accomplish what we want them to accomplish. And this is perfectly logical in the mind of a technocrat.
Well, this is what you talk about. I think it was in chapter 9 of your book, the total surveillance society. I mean,
that's right.
Tell me we're not going headlong right into that right now.
we're already there. By and large, we're already there. The only good thing that's saving us from the grips of this thing is that they don't have the computing power to analyze all the data they're collecting. They're merely collecting the data today. They don't have the processing power nor the artificial intelligence algorithms created yet to analyze these masses of data that they're collecting.
Huge. It's huge.
But it's coming.
Yeah, well, yeah. And when that technology is here, they're already preloaded.
That's right. They're preloaded.
They've got all the data.
They got all the data in place.
Well, with the smart, you look at the smart grid. So now they know when you're home, what appliances you use, all that, all the inner workings of that. They know everything about your health. They know everything about your family, the internal workings from your children, because they get that all through the assessments in Common Core.
Yep.
Do your parents own their house or rent? Do they fight about money? Do you guys own firearms? Do you go to church? Do they punish you? You know, all these kinds of things are all being captured, and then they decide who they lean on, you know, who they watch a little bit extra, who's probably going to get off the reservation, you know.
That's right. And not to mention all emails, all phone calls, you know, all other communications that they can get a hold of.
Oh, yeah.
They're scanning all the mail. Every piece of mail now is being scanned by the somebody within the post office to record what's going where.
Not necessarily
the documents inside, but they know where it's going. That's the meta information, if you will, the address it came from and the address it's going to.
So they know
who communicates with who. This would be a good time, if we got a minute, to read the first five requirements of Technocracy, Inc. from 1934.
Sure.
People just need to grasp this. Just listen to this in context of our conversation here about smart grid on one hand and big data on the other. Number one, this is a direct quote out of the Technocracy Study course written in 1934 by M. King Hubbard. Number one, register on a continuous 24-hour-per-day basis the total net conversion of energy. Number two, by means of the registration of energy converted and consumed, make possible a balanced load. I'll time out on that. How many times have you heard the word balanced load come out of your local utility?
Mm-hmm.
That's all they talk about. Okay, number three, provide a continuous inventory of all production and consumption. Number four, provide a specific registration of the type, kind, etc. of all goods and services, where produced and where used. Number five, listen to this one very carefully. Provide specific registration of the consumption of each individual, plus a record and description of the individual.
Wow.
Close quote.
And that was in 1934.
That was 1934. This is exactly what they're doing to us now, Aaron. This is exactly what they're doing to us today, and I cannot specify it enough. There are no mathematical odds that you can say that they're accomplishing this today without pointing back to this document in 1934. You cannot possibly calculate any statistical odds that this just happened by chance.
Yeah.
It just doesn't fit.
Not possible. And then you look at the people. You did a really good job in the book of bringing forward all the folks that are in the background that go back way into the 1800s.
Oh, yes.
So this predates even the concept of technology. I mean, there was no technology really, not like we have.
We wouldn't recognize, I mean, we'd say technology today, we think of iPhones and iWatch and, you know, all the latest, greatest stuff. But there was a tremendous awareness that technology was impacting the world, even back in the early, in the late 1700s. And it got more, I'm sure, as time went on. But by the time the 1800s were coming to a close, there was a whole plethora of writings and philosophies and stuff that revolved around this technology stuff that was coming in. The technocrats believed just the presence of technology was changing the fabric of society, and that's why politicians were incapable of running it, because they didn't know anything about technology. That's, you know, they blamed the politicians on the Great Depression because they were stupid, ignorant. They didn't know what they were doing. They had no concept of the technology that they were wielding around. And so that's why, that was reason for them, that the people should turn over the operation of society to science and engineers.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Unelected.
One of these technocrats actually called for Roosevelt to install himself as dictator in order to implement technocracy.
Oh, yeah. Forgot about that.
Yeah.
Okay,
we had,
let's do that part when we come back, because that was interesting.
Yeah, that was a great story.
This whole thing was like a trip through history for all the stuff that they left out. It's like the other history.
All the stuff they don't want you to know about.
The rest of history. We will be right back. You're listening to We the People Radio. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us, here at KCNR, 1460 AM. Shasta ready.
We don't need no education. We don't need no thought control. No dark sarcasm in the classroom.
And unicorns and puppies.
Oh, yeah, puppies.
So,
there was actually a certain amount of irony, as there usually is with anything Steely Dan or Donald Fagen, but he sang that in 1981. From the perspective of 1976, looking back at 1957, the IGY, or International Geophysical Year, which is right up technocracy's alley.
Do you know about that, Mr. Wood?
No, not in detail.
International Geophysical Year. I need to get out more.
It says the IGY refers to International Geophysical Year, an event that ran from July 1957 to December 1958. The IGY was an international scientific project promoting collaboration among the world's scientists.
I was only 2 years old, so I get a pass on that one.
They were busy creeping up on us then, too.
Fagan's lyrical reference from the point of view of that time, the 50s in other words, an optimistic vision of futuristic concepts such as solar-powered cities, a transatlantic tunnel, permanent space stations, and spandex jackets.
Yeah, baby.
He was all primed for the 80s.
Don't forget the big collars.
What about the big hair?
And the fruit boots.
That's right, we can't leave out the fruit boots. So these guys really, they really believe that if we turn everything over to the bureaucrats, that they'll be super fair, that it's going
to
be...
Not to the bureaucrats, to the technocrats.
Technocrats, sorry about that. And
they hated bureaucrats, actually. They hated politicians.
But they need the bureaucrats to carry this out. What are the technocrats? How are they going to keep us all in line?
That's right. So who's the useful idiot, you see?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, no kidding.
Who gets the condo and who gets the tent?
Politicians are the useful idiots, and that's why Congress has been neutered, completely irrelevant today, and can get nothing done to curtail what the administration does. And by the way, I wanted to mention, do you know all the whole raft of environmental regulations Obama's releasing right now?
Okay.
I'm sure you're aware of those because I know you watch those things up there in your area. He's doing more today than ever been done in the history of, this whole thing about environment, climate change, clamping down on all kinds of stuff. All the Agenda 21 stuff.
All the green economy is coming.
Do you know the man who is standing beside Obama, crafting his entire policy for climate change?
Fellow Jarrett?
Mr. Rogers?
No. No, you wish.
I was closer with Valerie Jarrett, you knucklehead.
Oh, I know who it is. It's James.
Podesta.
Oh, it's not James Podesta. Taylor?
John Podesta. Oh, yeah, I should have known.
He is the man. And he is widely acknowledged. He is the sole architect. Even New York Times has said it. The National Journal has written about it. Nobody questions the fact that if it weren't for John Podesta, Obama would not have a climate change policy today, and he is driving it. He's driving the executive orders. He's driving all the rules that are coming out of the EPA. He crafted many of these things himself. And Mr. John Podesta, who just came off of a stint with United Nations working on a global basis for a new strategy to implement climate change around the world, he came into the White House about late in 2013, crafted all these things, got all these things done. He was Bill Clinton's chief of staff back in the 90s, by the way, and taught him how to use executive orders as well. Mr. Podesta is a member of the Trilateral Commission.
Oh, what a surprise.
What a surprise. Let me give you one other fact. We talked about big data.
Yeah.
Back in 2005, George Bush created the office that would take charge over all the different agencies, intelligence agencies in the country. It was called the Director of National Intelligence. That was the office that would take the leadership and supposedly coordinate every policy across all the 17 or 18 different intelligence agencies that our government has. The Director of National Intelligence is a critically important position for anybody that's going to be involved in collecting all this data, because they're the ones that the NSA is part of the office of that office. And so the very first person who created the office for George Bush was John Negroponte. He was chosen to be the first director of national intelligence and to set up the department, to organize it, to get all the infrastructure set up, to control everything, et cetera, et cetera. John Negroponte was a member of the Trilateral Commission.
Hmm.
Just coincidence?
Yeah.
I don't think so. Yeah. And there have been a couple of other members of Trilateral Commission holding that position since then as well.
How many members of the Trilateral Commission are actually in the administration today? Do you know?
I think right now there's somewhere around 12.
Wow.
At least half of those are in the State Department, but Susan Rice is a member. She's the NSA right now. In other words, the Assistant to the President for National Security Affairs, right? She's the gatekeeper to the President.
And actually, to be a member of the TLC, you have to pretty much go along with the program.
Of course you do.
You are the program.
You're
a mover and shaker. You're a principal at that point. If you're a member of the Trilateral Commission, you're a principal.
Yeah.
You're not just a wannabe.
Yeah, no, you're going to
arrived.
Yeah, you have arrived, and your job is to implement the plan.
Dianne Feinstein is a member. Welcome to California.
Yeah, exactly.
She's been a member of the Trilateral Commission for years, and isn't it just wonderful that her husband just got a $1 billion contract from the government to sell and deal with postal U.S. post office properties?
Mm. Wow.
$1 billion in commissions up for grabs.
Good Lord.
Dianne Feinstein's her husband just happens to get the contract.
Yeah. What's the chances?
Uh-huh.
That was probably just a little coincidence.
Just coincidence. Just coincidence. Purely coincidence.
Yeah. Well, there was probably nobody else even bid for the thing, because nobody else was in the whole entire country was qualified.
Exactly. Well, and so the Trilateral Commission was designed as a multi. I mean, you go through this whole thing with the North American Union,
right?
And you talk about the European Union. So you bring in Japan, you bring in Europe, you bring in the United States. Well, and now they want an international economic order. Well, you can't have that and sovereignty at the same time.
You cannot. And they invented all these different unions, by the way. They were instrumental in the North American Union, which has not actually taken place yet, but they're still working on it.
Yeah.
And they brought us the European Union in the same fashion. It was David Rockefeller even wrote about it and boasted how their people early on had laid the groundwork for the European Union to come about. And the actual one of the first major charters that was written for the European Union was written by Valerie Giscard d'Estaing, who was a technocrat, and he was a member of the Trilateral Commission. He actually wrote the charter. You can't get any closer than that.
Probably knows James
that's
Taylor.
Pretty much right.
Yeah. So they're the ones that have brought this to us. And you look at the state of the world, on one hand you can say it's broken beyond repair, And you'd be correct there. But what is not immediately apparent is that technocracy is competing head to head with capitalism, and capitalism is losing. That's why we're losing our middle class. That's why we're losing, you know, there's a turnover of wealth in the world today. These two systems are competing economic systems.
Yeah, totally incompatible or incompatible. You got to have either or in every aspect.
So they're making everything about capitalism look like it's failing, look like that's the problem.
That's right.
That's what we need to get rid of. And people are really focused that they're trying to replace our system with socialism.
Well, how many times have you heard, it's the big corporations. We got to get rid of them.
Yes. It's not. Yeah, I know. It is and it isn't. It isn't socialism. It isn't communism. It is totalitarian.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the Trilateral Commission, like you said, they don't want to run it. They just want to reap the benefits of it.
That's right. And, yeah. But, you know, I think they will probably end up running it in the end. But, you know, if you examine, so many things could be answered looking at this green economy thing. You know, we talk about things like public-private partnership. We talk about reinvention of government, all these things. The United Nations Environmental Program, UNEP, the infamous group, they wrote in one of their pages on this stuff, on green economy, they quote, "A green economy implies a decoupling of resource use and environmental impacts from economic growth. These investments, both public and private, provide the mechanism for the reconfiguration of business, infrastructure, and institutions, and for the adoption of sustainable consumption and production processes." That is it, close quote. That's a nutshell. That's it. That's right there. That's what they're doing. They're reconfiguring business, infrastructure, and institutions. And businesses, that's good. They need to be reconstructed, you might say. But when you talk about infrastructure and institutions, we're talking about government. We're talking about the very fabric of our society. They're reforming the whole kit and caboodle. They're reconfiguring everything.
Oh, sure. In the end, it's all going to work for government. It's all,
but it won't be elected. It won't be an elected form of government like we have.
No, it's not.
And it is interesting, though. People turn around and blame the elected people, but actually, they're victims of it too.
They are. The technocrats that are hiding behind the scenes, the people like the John Podestas of the world, they're unaccountable and they're unreachable. You can't get John Podesta fired. He wasn't elected in the first place. He was hired by the president. You could protest all you want. You cannot possibly get him fired or change his policy one iota.
He's untouchable.
And how many more of these people are in our government, untouchable, hiding behind somebody, knowing exactly what they're doing, and they're changing the very fabric of society, yet even Congress cannot touch these people. Congress can't get John Podesta fired, even if they wanted to.
Yeah, and people ask all the time, well, why don't they do something? Why don't they do something?
They can't.
They can't.
Yeah, what exactly would you have them do?
Well, our system was never designed to have people like that.
You're right.
Because we have two things happening at the same time that are really on mutually exclusive tracks, that's why we can't reach across and get a hold of it, because it's not in our playing field.
I know.
That we're used to, that we know about.
This is one of the reasons, by the way, we say that we need to think globally, but we need to act locally and, you know, start rooting this stuff out from the ground up.
We're coming back with you in 2 minutes, and as with all things, we'll spend the last 5 minutes talking about what we can do about it. Unfortunately, we spent a lot more time on the problem. But it's a big problem, and people need to get it. So, quick little break here. We'll be back with you. You're listening to KCNR 1460 AM.
Got so many voices.
know it's Susan Rice at the NSA, member of the Trilateral Commission.
Yeah.
All right, Mr. Wood, so what are we going to do about this? I feel like I'm back in elementary school. Just say no.
don't
do we have a better do we have a better plan? Uh-oh. Did we lose him? Did we hang up on him? Is he muted?
I'm sorry, there I was just muted. I am here.
Well, there
you
go.
I would just want to say that we need to adopt a different strategy than what we've had in the past. And for all the energy that is put out by people struggling with congressional races, senatorial races, and all that kind of stuff, and I know we need good people in Washington. I'm not saying we don't. We don't want to just turn it over to dogs. But for all the effort we put into it, what we've gotten out of it is virtually zip. Over the last 40 years, for all the millions of man hours that have been put into political elections trying to get things better, we're worse off today than we've ever been in history, and we have no prospect of changing it using the current course. And I would suggest that's the classic definition of insanity. Trying to, you know, doing the same thing over and over, expecting different results. And we're not getting different results from it. And we haven't, even with this new round of senators and Congress, you know, freshman congressmen we're bringing in, they're still just as hamstrung as they were when they were Democrat. It is not an issue of being Democrat or Republican, liberal or conservative. It's a question of the American society against technocracy and against technocrats. That's what it's all about in the end. And so if that's the case, that means we need to refocus a lot of our energy on dealing with technocrats rather than dealing with politicians, because politicians are no more able to change things than you and I are. The people just need to stand up.
Yeah, because when we're
if you don't know the enemy, you can't, you know, what are you going to stand up for?
Sure.
You have to know who the enemy is.
We're constantly told stupid things that are not scientific. And when the scientific evidence points to a different solution, the technocrats just continue to say, nope, that's the best scientific answer.
Yes,
and,
that's right.
And at the end of the day, you can't vote somebody in who's going to fix that.
That's right.
Not to say it isn't worth trying, you know, as far as not allowing them to regulate and pass laws and cutting their budget. I mean, they just cut the EPA back to 1989 staffing levels for all the people still boo-hooing about the omnibus bill. That was one little blessing in there.
Yes.
But
we can't touch them from the top down.
No.
But we can touch them from the bottom up, because in your community, wherever you might happen to live, whether it's a town or a big city or whatever, you can go down to your city council meetings. You can go to your planning committee meetings. You can go to the various, you know, public meetings that you have where these technocrats have to sit in. And when this kind of stuff comes up, you need to engage them and say no and make such a stink until you run them off the platform. And many people have done this, by the way. There's a rash of success stories where local citizens have made huge changes in their own community by saying no and by making a stink and saying, this is not American, this is not right, this is leading to tyranny, or whatever the case is. And they get these people to back off. But if we don't adopt this kind of strategy, I'm afraid that, you know, people will continue to waste their time on national elections thinking that's going to do something, you know, to change everything. It's not going to do one iota's worth of good.
Well, the whole Islam thing, I think, at this point, is just, I don't know, it might just be another vehicle for them to take more of our rights away, to, just to stop that. I mean, it's
sure. Well, and what a great way timing. To transform the religion thing, right?
Oh, yeah,
it's
sure.
Part of the transformation.
It's a crisis. Yeah, it's a crisis that demands to be managed.
Sure.
But, you know, you're up against just such a large thing. I mean, even consider that the Pope today, he's in Manila. This is a headline New York Times story out of Europe. The Pope is on the bandwagon for climate change and global warming, and he says, quote, as stewards of God's creation, we're called to make Earth a beautiful garden for the human family. When we destroy forests, we ravage our soil and pollute the seas, we betray that noble calling.
Yeah, I'm thinking he might be running aground.
All together now, let's just go and bang our heads on the desk. But not too hard, otherwise we won't make it into the next. They'll call us defective, and we all know how that turns out.
Patrick, great show. We really appreciate you coming on.
And make your own mind up. That's all I can say.
Absolutely. Please get
Technocracy Rising.
Get the book. It's awesome. Oh, and technocracyrising.com is the website due, and we've got that on
good
there.
Place. Absolutely.
Thank you, Mr. Wood. We will chat with you later on. Bob, Bill.
My pleasure. God bless you all.
Bye, all. Thanks for listening.
Signing off. WeThePeopleRadio.us for all the fun and frivolity you can handle in one place and still make blood shoot out of your eyes.
Determine if any rounds hit anything.